Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio. Brian Lehrer with you live in the green space today. Our green space audience, you were able to see that I have, even after all this time, not memorized the full legal ID as I was reading all those little New Jersey stations off my iPad. Listeners, we are live in the green space today, and when we are live in the green space, you can watch the Brian Lehrer Show as well as listen. So if you want to watch live streaming video, you can do that at WNYC.org. We have it right on the homepage of our website or on the WNYC Facebook page as well. Now, we're just about done with our series, The Eights, A Brief History of the Culture Wars, decade by decade, starting with 1948. We've spent the last 6 weeks playing historical audio and speaking with guests and taking your oral history calls to help reconstruct some of how we got to this place of such intense polarization and alienation as we are in today. So here in 2018, the very latest polls show it over the issue of separating children from their parents at the border if the parents cross illegally, as we discussed in our segment before the news. And again, Trump's overall approval rating in the new Gallup poll is right in line with other presidents' approval ratings at this point in their terms, just after the 500-day mark. Obama also 45%, Bill Clinton 44%. The abnormal president is in the normal range. And one possible conclusion is that the president may be abnormal by historical standards, but the feelings of the people are not. There's a culture war that's been going on since the 1960s is one way to look at it. We could go back even much further to look at it another way, but it's largely over who Americans think does more harm than good and who feels included or alienated by the decisions of national leaders. So today and tomorrow, we will wrap up this series with some concluding thoughts and the results of a survey we produced with the Harris Poll in conjunction with the series. We'll get to the poll in a minute, but let me pull out just a couple of history clips that we played earlier. One is an expanded version, and say our country faces a stark choice about which America we want to be. I'm going to play Pat Buchanan from the 1992 Republican Convention and Barack Obama from the 2004 Democratic Convention. Buchanan in 92, after running against the first President Bush in the primaries and losing, obviously, had his most famous moment, the Pat Buchanan culture war speech.
There is a religious war going on in this country. It is a cultural war as critical to the kind of nation we shall be as the Cold War itself, for this war is for the soul of America. And in that struggle for the soul of America, Clinton and Clinton are on the other side, and George Bush is on our side.
And what were some elements of that culture war, according to Pat Buchanan?
The agenda that Clinton and Clinton would impose on America. Abortion on demand, a litmus test for the Supreme Court, homosexual rights, discrimination against religious schools, women in combat units. That's change, all right. But that's not the kind of change America needs. It's not the kind of change America wants. And it's not the kind of change we can abide in a nation we still call God's country.
So that was Buchanan in 92. Interesting that in both those excerpts, he didn't just say Bill Clinton, he said Clinton and Clinton. So already, not even being a candidate for anything, Hillary Clinton was a culture war devil and used that way by that side. So he was speaking to the alienation of the American cultural right, and he lost the primaries, but validated a certain kind of culture war's passion that predated Clinton Lewinsky and predated NAFTA and predated the last 25 years of large-scale immigration. None of that had happened in 1992. It was there since the 60s, and in a way, since before the Civil War, for Pat Buchanan to stoke and stroke, and it dogged Bill Clinton his whole 8 years. So along came Barack Obama in 2004.
E pluribus unum, out of many, one. Now, even as we speak, there are those who are preparing to divide us. The spin masters, the negative ad peddlers, who embrace the politics of anything goes. Well, I say to them tonight, there is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America. There is not a black America and a white America and Latino America and Asian America. There's the United States of America.
And maybe that sounds a little naive through the lens of 2018. But which America do we want to have? Maybe our fate as a country is to ride that wave back and forth between cultural fight club and the desire for resolution. And today, obviously, we have the closest thing to Pat Buchanan as president as we've ever had in modern times. Weird that it comes after Obama not only got elected, but reelected. It could actually be that McCain and Romney weren't culture warriors enough to maximize Republican turnout, while Obama's No Red America, No Blue America, post-baby boom, post-culture wars, post-partisan, post-race, also failed to bridge the gap. So our goal with the Harris poll was to learn from a wide cross-section of Americans, this is a national poll, about some things that unite us and some things that divide us, and look for opportunities to move forward more as one country while respecting people's differences and how alienated different groups of Americans can feel, often for legitimate reasons. In fact, almost every year since 1966, the Harris Poll has published what they call an alienation index, the results of a survey intended to see how alienated people are from the elites, if you want to put it that way, or leadership in this country. And little history, the alienation index went up steadily during the Obama years. That's not to say the president was necessarily to blame, but alienation rose from 2009 to 2014, stayed at that peak through 2016, and actually came down a little during the first year of the Trump administration. On the scale they have of 1 to 100, the alien index was 29 when it started out in 1966. It rose steadily for the next decade, the divisive Vietnam and Watergate and counterculture years, and basically never recovered, staying in the 50s and 60s out of 100 ever since. And during Obama, the alienation was 52 in 2010, 63 in 2011, 67 in 2013, and a record high of 70 in 2014 and 2016. It came down, though just a bit, to 67 last year, the first year of President Trump. We will look more closely at those numbers as we bring in our guests, Michael D'Antonio, executive editor of the Harris Poll and author of books including The Athena Doctrine, How Women and the Men Who Think Like Them Will Rule the Future. He also wrote The Truth About Trump and has a forthcoming book about Mike Pence called The Shadow President. And for another set of academic eyes on these results, Christina Greer, Fordham political science professor and author of the book, Black Ethnics, Race, Immigration, and the Pursuit of the American Dream. Christina and Michael, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian.
Good morning.
And before we get to the new poll, Michael, let's look at what it was meant to build on. I've been laying out for the listeners a bit of the history of the Harris Alienation Index, which is based on the scores people give to five alienation statements. The people running the country don't really care what happens to you. The rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. Most people in power try to take advantage of people like you. What you think doesn't count, what you think doesn't count very much anymore. And you are left out of things going on around you. What are those questions trying to get at?
I think they're trying to get at people's sense of whether of agency in the world and in their lives. Do they feel powerful in a way as citizens? And it's a measure of well-being. My own sense of well-being might be determined by my sense of control and whether these systems that seem so broad actually respond to me. And we have found over the years that this varies a lot by who's in power at the moment and who we're polling. So if you're polling the general population and there's this division politically, we would see that, for example, during the Obama administration, that white conservatives became ever more alienated, especially rural white conservatives. But then it also spilled into people identified as Democrats and people identified as Obama voters. There's also, I think, something that began to happen in the 60s and accelerated in the 70s, and that was the active manipulation of people's sense of well-being. The mass media that existed after World War II started to reach into people's lives in a new way. You know, you didn't have to sit down and consider something in the newspaper. You could sort of take it in passively through the television. And both political parties started to exploit anxieties, especially in the 60s and 70s, with Nixon's Southern strategy, which was first employed in 68 and then in 72 more aggressively, this idea that whites were somehow losing as others may gain started to take hold. And so one of the things that popped out to me was how idealistic Americans were during the 70s. People went from believing that what made America great was equal opportunity, getting along with other nations, free education, and a higher standard of living in the 70s, to completely materialistic views of what would make America great going forward after 78. It was all about how hard you worked, natural resources, industrial know-how, and military strength. So you could see that there was a window in the late 60s when people did feel less alienated, felt like there were these ideals they could aspire to, but that sense of good feeling was lost.
So a country with an overall 70% alienation index is a pretty darn alienated country and is likely to be a country at war with its elites in particular. And here's a little deeper dive. In the later Obama years, Republicans, as you might imagine, felt the most alienated, but Democrats felt what Harris calls the most isolated. There was little difference by age group and little difference by gender. So alienation tended to run along these party lines, which these days is increasingly a proxy for race. The roles dramatically flipped last year, with Democrats now feeling more alienated with a 67 alienation index, and Republicans down at 51. And that is a really dramatic finding here, to my eye. The alienation among Republicans plummeted from 69 in the year before the election to 51 a year after the election, while Democrats didn't even go up. It remained about as alienated as before, around 67 out of 100. And alienation among men dropped more than among women, not surprisingly under Trump, an 8-point improvement. But alienation among women still went down 4 points as well, meaning Trump even made Republican women, I guess, Michael, feel more included on average.
Well, and what's important to consider about this is, could lives have changed so substantially in the first year of the Trump administration that this would be based on something real and concrete in people's lives? The answer obviously is no, but
well, at least his attitude and his speech.
The symbols of power changed. And what you noted about people's anxieties about the elite is fascinating to consider, because Trump came from an incredibly elite background, Ivy educated, a billionaire, depending on whether you believe him.
I don't.
perhaps one time, maybe 10 times over. And yet the vision of this person in the White House did make many people feel less alienated. And I think that should make us ask, what was it about his predecessor that made so many people uncomfortable?
So Christina, as it turns out, in this case... Well, you could take that if you want.
I mean, I just think it's a one-word answer, racism. I mean, this is a country, we have to remember, just because Democrats did an eight-year victory lap patting themselves on the back that they elected a black man, we still have to remember, you know, we lost state houses, we lost governorships. I mean, there were a lot of things that were in motion.
Democrats
during,
did all that time.
All during the 8 years of Obama and even before. And I always remind people, I'm like, this is still a country that has four pillars, and that's capitalism, anti-black racism, white supremacy, and patriarchy. And they came in this beautiful package called Donald Trump, but they were never gone. You know, so when people say, this isn't the country we know, it is. Read a book. I mean, so like when we say, like, you know, like when we say, okay, Republican women, this is, you know, obviously when we think about intersectionality, we're saying white women for the most part. So when it's just like, okay, well, women are feeling less alienated. Well, white women are feeling less alienated because we know that white women in many ways, especially white Republican women, have been the keepers of patriarchy through time, right? So none of this stuff is new. I think it's just the way in the 21st century that we've seen racism on display. And so I thought that these results were interesting for sure, but you know, we know that for a lot of white Americans, Democrats and Republicans, equity equals discrimination. So in trying to level a playing field, many people feel as though something's being taken away, even if nothing's being taken away. It's just this perception of, I'm actually trying to pull in more people to have an equitable experience in America.
One piece of pushback that some people would would say to that, to some of what you said, is that, but wait, we didn't only elect Obama, we re-elected Obama. So yeah. What does that say about racism in white America?
I think that, you know, looking at a lot of the Obama voters who then turned around and voted for Trump, I think that Obama was an aspirational figure in the same way that Trump is an aspirational figure. And so I would ask people from the cities or the coasts, as we say, to drive across the country and see sort of the destitute situations that many Americans, not just white Americans, but Americans full stop, are in. And I think Obama's message of hope sort of did carry over enough in 2012. And so then Trump came. Keep in mind, he had a 40-year head start. You know, he was in Ghostbusters, too. Like, he's been in our homes for a really long time, you know? Like, he's been on The Apprentice as this aspirational billionaire, who I think he's a thousandaire, but we haven't seen his taxes, so how would I know? But I think a lot of people saw him as this aspirational figure, and then a lot of other people, like, you know, he said a lot of things that people have been thinking for a very long time, which is, you know, you don't have because someone else took it from you. Sort of, I call it the Archie Bunker narrative, right? You're mad that the Jeffersons move into your neighborhood, you're even more mad when they move out of your neighborhood and they're doing even better. And so Obama represented sort of not just blackness, but all the sort of black and brown and Asian folks in his set, and the women in his cabinet and sort of in his orb, really did sort of start to weaken these pillars of white supremacy, anti-black racism, patriarchy, and capitalism. And so I think that's where we get this pendulum swing. I mean, we saw it with Dinkins to Giuliani, and we saw Giuliani troll Dinkins for 4 years the same exact way that Trump trolled Obama for 8 years. And so if we look around the country, and mayors especially, black mayors who are then succeeded by sort of, I would call, racist white mayors, it's a pattern that this country has had in quite some time. And we've seen it sort of with gender, and we've seen it with race.
So now to our new poll. We tested a number of things based on the recent news to see what made people feel more included and what made people feel less included. That is to see, while we are stuck in our political tribes, where some opportunities might be for easing alienation, easing the culture wars, and finding points of common ground, as well as to see where some major divisive fault lines are. So we'll present our findings over 2 days, today and tomorrow, focusing today more on things that unite us, according to these numbers, and tomorrow more on the findings of things that divide us. Now, as an overview, some unity items were making healthcare more affordable, being more open to alternative viewpoints, being involved more in your local community, and having more things for sale that were made in America. Those all drew really high scores of more than 80% of respondents saying those things would make them feel more included. Also in the 80% or higher range, if there was less discrimination based on people's identities or beliefs, If women had substantially more power and respect in society, even 72% of men said that, and more power and respect for African Americans tested almost as well in the high 70s. Even 70% of whites said they would feel more included if African Americans had more power. But maybe that's just what many people thought the pollsters wanted to hear,
right?
Because the idea of social justice was much more divisive by race than more power for women or blacks was. Maybe that phrase doesn't test well simply, but when asked if more social justice movements like Black Lives Matter and Me Too, both of those were cited in the question, would have a positive or negative impact on society, 70% of African Americans said positive to just 47% of whites, a whopping 30 points less. And immigration also breaks along racial lines. We'll talk a lot about that tomorrow. And half of white Americans, 50%, said Black Lives Matter is doing more harm than good. Only 14% of blacks said that. So Michael, can we drill down on some of the specifics? What struck you about things that polled really high as unifying items that would make people feel less alienated, more included, and what's just sort of an artifact of polling error?
Well, I think some of these views are an artifact of polling error and do indicate aspirational notions. If people don't want to tell a pollster, no, I don't think more power in the hands of black people is a good idea. I think we should hold it ourselves as white people. That's just not going to come out. And this is why many election pollsters fail to call elections in cities effectively, because if a black candidate is strong, the whites will not say that they're going to vote against him or her. They just will do it. And so you wind up with election night results that are surprising. But this other issue of asking people, does the Black Lives Matter movement help or hurt? There we got a majority of whites saying that it hurts. It's a slim majority, but it was a majority. And this echoes what was revealed during the civil rights movement in the 1960s. Whites were almost always against the civil rights movement when polled. And there was even anxiety in the black community about certain leaders who were perceived as too strident, asking for too much, maybe posing a danger of a backlash. And life experience tells us that these backlashes do happen. So we're living through one right now. And that idea that you expressed of riding the wave in and out really is what we experience. The question then becomes, what do people really want? And I think the interesting response about they would feel more included in society if people were more open to alternative viewpoints and engaging others in meaningful debate. That was 82%. I suspect that a lot of it is people wanting others to listen to them.
You know, right, rather than volunteering to listen to others.
One of the other things that was expressed as a very high value was if people were more involved in their local communities. That was 86%. Now, in New York City, that could mean being involved with the people on the floor of your apartment building. That could be mm-hmm. your local sure. community, and it could be very productive. But there's also an element of raising the drawbridge that people express when they're talking about their local communities. Local control became a stand-in for segregation after the 1950s, especially in school districts. So you have to dig beyond these responses, especially when they're big. When it's 82% saying people should listen to each other more, what are they really saying?
Yeah, and Christina, one way to look at this whole history of post-World War II America that we've been doing these last 6 weeks is that it's a history of social progress and backlash, and mm-hmm. social progress and backlash.
Right, and I think also people liking things in theory. I mean, this is what Michael and I were talking about before we joined you. You know, the people who said that they want more community, you know, I'm just going to take the Upper West Side, for example, right? Of course, they love diversity, but not when your kids are going to go to school with my kids. that's when the rubber hits the road, right? So in theory, yes, we want, you know, to have these conversations. Can we really have a conversation if you're wearing a Make America Great Again hat? And we know that in high schools across the country, kids are doing that essentially because they can't wear a Confederate flag, right? Or if they're playing a Latino sports team, they'll just start chanting Trump because that means something. So I would love to sort of dig through these results with sort of some follow-up qualitative interviews, because when we think about sort of health and wellness, you know, we know social scientists have polled different people that say, you know, how do you feel about the Affordable Care Act? I love it. It's great. It's going to help me and my family. So how do you feel about Obamacare? The worst thing ever. I can't believe he's taking all of our tax money. You know, so I mean, this is, there is this racialized undercurrent to how we even conceptualize some of these concepts.
Well, and that difference does speak to the idea of political marketing. So everything was marketed as anti-Obama by one side of the debate, right, over the Affordable Care Act, where people loved all the parts of it, but when it was attached to this figure, then it, right, became a negative. And, you know, I think that one area where I think leadership has been lacking actually has been in the spiritual and religious community, because these aspirations that you're talking about are whispers from our higher selves. And who is amplifying those whispers and who is working to drown them out? If you're saying that there's a culture war and that this is God's country and you're defining what all those terms mean, are you providing the leadership that calls people to their higher selves, or are you being divisive?
But I think we can look at white evangelicals across the country who have supported this president, and I think that that's eroded the trust in what a spiritual leader means, right? So this is a man who can say Muslims, you know, need to be banned from this country, just full stop. Mexicans are rapists. Black people should just be incarcerated. I mean, I don't, he's just, he has a special feeling towards black folks. But we see that these evangelicals have always sort of stood up for Trump and said, finally, we have such a moral, you know, morally guided man in the White House, thrice married, you know.
But the new president of the Southern Baptist Convention is a young pastor who is in favor of doing something about climate change, who stood up against this policy on the border. There are young evangelicals who are rejecting this kind of leadership. And there's also a drop-off where some evangelical leaders are saying, we're killing the church. That if we tie ourselves to this politics too closely, we're going to lose our message of
evangelism. Well, because young people aren't in the church the way they have been in the past, and people in cities aren't as religious as other folks. Which, you know,
it's one of the biggest stats, as we've been following some changing statistics in America decade by decade, that pops the most, is that in 1948, just 2% of Americans said they had no religion, religious identification in particular. One recent poll found that about 35% of millennials say that.
Mm-hmm. So then that begs the question of where have the leaders who would call people to an example of faith that is inspiring, where have they gone? Where are the people who are calling us to act on behalf of our brothers and sisters? I think,
of course, religion is not the only source of that.
It isn't. But if people of faith abandon it, then I think that says a lot. And so far, I think that's the trend, is that people are abandoning that open vision of spirituality and religion.
With Michael D'Antonio from the Harris Poll and Christina Greer, Fordham political science professor, will continue in a minute from the Green Space. Our phone number, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Or here in the audience, just raise your hand. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, live in the Green Space today with a very buzzy audience. Boy, you guys are prompting some conversation among the troops. So those of you listening alone out there, people listen to the radio alone. How do you all, those of you who came to the Green Space, you're radio listeners, where do you listen? Do you listen in your kitchen? bathroom, somebody said. You listen in the car. Radio is such a solitary experience usually. So talk about building community. It's great to see so many people here in the green space and that you are so buzzy during the breaks. We are wrapping up our series, The Eights, A Brief History of the Culture Wars, today and tomorrow with some concluding thoughts and the results of a new WNYC Harris poll we did in conjunction with the series on what unites us, who's doing more good or harm, what divides us, and what's going to make America great in the future compared to in the past. We're focusing on the more uniting findings today, the more dividing ones tomorrow. But to dip into the historical audio vault for just a second, to get another example of how much things have changed. Right after World War II, when the Western Allies were bent on preventing anything as horrific again as a world war or the Holocaust, they started to set up international institutions and to talk in terms of international standards of behavior and global norms based on the notion of common humanity more than ever before. So 1948 was the year the World Trade Organization was established. I know, mixed results. And the year of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which human rights advocate and former First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt celebrated upon its inception.
We stand today at the threshold of a great event, both in the life of the United Nations and in the life of mankind. This Universal Declaration of Human Rights may well become the international Magna Carta of all men everywhere.
How different from today, when the president could say this on Fox News Channel last week after meeting with Kim Jong-un.
He's the head of a country, and I mean, he's the strong head. Mm-hmm. Don't let anyone think anything different. Right. He speaks and his people sit up at attention. I want my people to do the right. same.
So later, a CNN reporter asked him,
"What did you mean just now when you said you wished Americans would sit up at attention when you
spoke?" I'm kidding. Like, you don't understand. Sorry.
Mr. President.
Okay, but even if he was kidding, certainly it's new in 2018 that an American president could make that kind of a joke about massively human rights violating heads of state. We're not in 1948 anymore, Mrs. Roosevelt. Still with us are two guests, Michael D'Antonio, executive editor of the Harris Poll and author of books including The Athena Doctrine, How Women and Men Who Think Like Them Will Rule the Future, The Truth About Trump, and a forthcoming book about Mike Pence called The Shadow President. And for another set of academic eyes on our poll results, Christina Greer, Fordham political science professor and author of Black Ethnics, Race, Immigration, and the Pursuit of the American Dream. And Christina, I actually want to take that Trump quip kind of seriously in the context of the culture wars and the Harris Poll Alienation Index, because I think, historically speaking, alienation works against a strong belief in democracy and for a willingness to identify with a strong man.
Right, and I think we have to go back to, you know, some of the polls that were taken when Obama was president, and a lot of Republicans felt like we were losing, losing our stature in the world, losing our stature to these immigrants, and they wanted sort of this big, strong dad figure, if you will, to come in. I think also we have to remember the vast majority of white people in America have never had a black boss, right, let alone a black friend. So they've had black people in their employ, but they've never had black leadership. And so that is something that collectively as a nation, we were detangling for 8 years. Trump then comes along and sort of, you know, we have a conversation about Puerto Rico yesterday at the UN. The United States is not present. About Puerto Rico, right? Other countries are there, but we're not there because we walked away. You know, part of the rhetoric that he said when he descended that gold escalator in 2016 was that he didn't want the UN, right? He doesn't want to be a player internationally. And part of the problem now is that our international allies are going to figure out a world without us. Slowly but surely, Germany and England and France and lots of other former friends are saying, well, if you all are attaching yourselves with, you know, Russia and North Korea and whomever else, we'll figure it out on our own. And so this Western alliance post-World War II is now something that, I'm not going to say is dissolved, but is swiftly dissolving under this president.
Let's take a phone call. On line 10, David in Crown Heights. David, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was just responding to, I know we spoke about race and this kind of blowback from Obama to Trump, but also there's the economic factor, being we had this huge economic crash. You know, people lost their livelihoods and all their savings, so we go for this billionaire who obviously is you know, basking in this idea that he's the savior based on his business acumen. So, I mean, it seems not a coincidence to me that there is this connection between the economic crash and everybody's, you know, new life, you know, experiencing hardship, and this idea that he's going to be this white and also very, very rich savior of a businessman.
David,
thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'll tell a story. I was in Central Park playing softball in 2016, and this, I believe he was an African immigrant, selling soda and, you know, other soft drinks and water in the park. That's how he was making his living. And he recognized me and he said, "So, what do you think about Trump?" This is 2015. And I said, "Well, what do you think about Trump?" And he said, "Well, you know, maybe he can create a lot of jobs." Mm-hmm. And just, it's, you know, considering the demographics and the time, and it was a salient story, and it never left me. Let's go to David in New Rochelle on line 9. David, you're on WNYC.
Hi, thanks, Brian. I'm just hoping that the next, you know, Democrat who comes, you know, kind of the leader of the party, is able to, you know, stand up for some of these social issues in a way that I don't feel like we've heard from the Democratic leadership since basically Obama, some of his speeches in 2008. I was sort of hoping when he was elected that we'd have more of a Bill Clinton who spoke out when Matthew Shepard was killed and there was some atrocities in Texas. He would always be front and center speaking out on that. And I don't feel like that's happened the last 10 years. And I think in the void, and we can debate why, you know, people like Coates and others have their theories that I subscribe to, but I feel like in the absence of that, in the void of that, we had someone step in and promulgate a lot of, you know, terrible things that swung the hearts and minds of former Obama or Clinton voters. And, you know, something my mom said to me in 2016 was, people don't know they're angry until you tell them that they're angry. So, you know, I think people can be swung back if we have the right leadership. Pelosi, Schumer, and others, their silence is deafening in my eyes. And I just finished reading John McCain's book, and he speaks out in his book on a lot of things I think we would agree with on immigrants and, you know, how they should be treated and how they actually contribute to our society. He speaks out more in his book than Democrats do, in my opinion. So I think we need a real look, and I'm hoping Tom Perez or others can really identify a leader who's aspirational.
David, thank you very much. It'll probably be more up to the people than the head of the Democratic Party, Tom Perez.
We're waiting for Tom Perez, and we'll be waiting quite some time.
Let's take one more comment, then we're going to be out of time. Who in the green space had your hand up? We have somebody here. Hi.
Thanks a lot, Brian. As you were rolling off that questionnaire of questions that constitute the alienation, I was kind of check, 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 check. And my problem is with the media. The lady in the previous segment asked, who's reliable? You know, why won't we talk to the mainstream media? And my problem is with the mainstream media because I believe that they're not listening to the people. I believe that the stories that they're reporting are not all there is to report. And my personal experience is with the judicial system, where I went to court, I tried to sue. The judge quite simply, you know, invented a totally bogus argument, replaced our argument with a totally bogus argument so as to decide the case the way they want to decide him. And time after time that happens, and finally I sued the judges, and I've been told that there is a case law that judges have the right to act maliciously and corruptly. And I just said, oh my goodness, if Trump tweeted tomorrow, I have the right to act maliciously and corruptly, the heaven, you know, the sky's going to fall and all
kinds. Half the people would believe him.
So, but I am amazed that here we have a whole branch of U.S. government that says we have the right to act maliciously and corruptly. the press not only does not want to talk about it, you know, on its own, but I go to the reporters, I talk to plenty of reporters, and they kind of look at me, you know, are you nuts? And so I'm saying, yeah, of course I do not have agency. Here is this outrage, this total absolute outrage where we do not have due process, is happening in front of everybody's eyes. And judges are so corrupt that they openly say, we are corrupt and malicious, and we are within our rights.
Thank you, sir.
And yet the press does not want to talk. So
one alienated American is going to get just about our last word, except for the two of you. Just give me a soundbite on this, because we're late for our next segment. Are we doomed, in your opinion, to have Pat Buchanan's America, where we just have to go back and forth and one side or another is going to win on culture war issues now and another time, and never to have Barack Obama's 2004 convention speech America?
Well, two things. One, I would say we need to also watch Jesse Jackson's 1988 convention speech and Al Sharpton's 2004 convention speech that happened 2 days prior to Obama's, which I think both of those are much more succinct and possibly better
speeches. Right, and I will say we played an extended excerpt of the Jesse Jackson speech this series.
Oh, good, yes. I hope that we're not going to just swing the pendulum, but I do think that we have to remember, we were talking about this earlier, what LBJ said. You know, he's like, if you convince the poorest white man that he's better than the Negro or immigrant or insert whatever 21st century name that you need to insert, it's like you can pick his pockets all day long. And I think that's what we're seeing right now with this particular administration, and I hope that the pendulum doesn't just swing back to sort of, you know, a Democrat that's sort of in line with, you know, progressivism, and then back to a hardcore Republican and this, that, and the other, because then we just have blue team versus red
Michael
team.
Short, and you're coming back tomorrow.
Well, I feel optimistic, actually. I think that our higher selves still reside inside of us, that it can be awakened, and I think it takes a lot of hard work to sustain progress, and we're being called to that hard work.
Part two of rolling out the WNYC Harris Poll at the end of our series, The Eights, with Michael D'Antonio and other guests tomorrow. See you then, executive editor of the Harris Poll, and we thank for partnering today Christina Greer, Fordham political science professor and author of Black Ethnics, Race, Immigration, and the Pursuit of the American Dream. Thank you both so much.
Thanks, Brian.
On WNYC, more to come.